Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 12th. Up first is Sean Spear, writing on how Canada's prosperity predicament goes mainstream, and everything else we learned in the Hub's third year.
Today ends the Hub's third full year in publication. To mark its first and second anniversaries, Hub readers permitted me to indulgently look back over the year at some of the things that we had learned. At the risk of testing their tolerance, here are 10 new things that we learned in year 3. 1. We learned that the Hub hasn't yet hit its growth ceiling. After doubling our web traffic in year 2, we doubled it again in year 3, exceeding 4 million page views for the year, including more than 500,000 in March alone. Maybe we'll hit a natural limit at some point, but we're not there yet. 2. The same goes for the Hub's podcasts, including its regular dialogues with leading thinkers like George Will, Tyler Cowen, and Coleman Hughes, its bi-weekly conversations with David Frum, the weekly Friday Roundtable, and new daily episodes of Hub Headlines. We reached nearly 100,000 downloads per month in year 3, and were consistently among the top 5 or 10 Canadian-based podcasts in Apple's Culture and Society category. We'd make a big point about how most of the podcasts ahead of us on the charts are produced by the CBC and supported by its $1 billion public subsidy, but we'll resist the temptation. 3. We learned that in the aftermath of Hamas's horrific attacks against Israel on October 7th, there were more people within our country whose instinct was to condemn our democratic ally rather than the terrorist organization that brutalized and murdered more than 1,200 Israeli civilians and soldiers than we would have anticipated. It's been a painful 6 months for Canadian Jews who have had to confront the same realization. The Hub has consistently spoken out against the attacks and in favor of Israel's ability to defend itself in the face of such a murderous threat and will continue to do so without equivocation. As we set out in an October essay, the editorial decision to support Israel isn't a hard one, it's a reflection of the ideas and values that animate the Hub itself. 4. We learned that growing numbers of Canadians share our concerns about the country's economic stagnation and declining living standards. After beating the drum on these alarming trends for the Hub's first 2 years, they finally went mainstream in year 3, including a major speech by the Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada in which she called Canada's poor productivity growth a national emergency. If the first step of addressing a problem is to finally recognize it, we feel good that the Hub has played a key role in diagnosing Canada's prosperity predicament. 5. We learned once again that the Trudeau government would much rather micromanage provincial child and healthcare systems, set municipal zoning rules, and deliver lunches at local schools than actually run the federal government itself. As evidence mounts that state capacity in core federal areas of responsibility like defense and national security has eroded, the Prime Minister nevertheless finds himself deeper and deeper into provincial and local issues. His unprecedented use of the federal spending power has effectively rewritten the division of powers that his own father codified in the Canadian Constitution. We at the Hub care a great deal about these trends. Regrettably, it's not obvious that many Canadians, including the provincial premiers themselves, do. 6. We learned that Canadians are conditional multiculturalists. They generally support Canada's immigration policy, including its high annual levels, if they believe that it's serving the country's economic interests. The unprecedented spike in total immigration over the past couple of years, particularly the massive increase in the number of temporary foreign workers and international students, is testing their conditional support. The Trudeau government is now scrambling to get things back under control, but serious damage may have already been done. Restoring public support will ultimately depend on one thing: reestablishing the principle that immigration policy ought to be set in the national interest, not the interests of businesses, post-secondary institutions, or politicians in search of wedge issues. 7. We learned that there's a lot of interest in the future of journalism in Canada. The Hub's highly ambitious Future of News series has enabled us to engage a wide range of voices and perspectives, including former Washington Post editor Marty Baron, National Review editor Rich Lowry, Globe and Mail columnist Andrew Coyne, Newsweek opinion editor Batya Ungar-Sargon, to independent journalist Tara Henley, and of course TVO host Steve Paikin, whose podcast episode inadvertently generated a bit of a buzz. We also profiled a number of news media outlets trying to build sustainable business models in today's fast-evolving marketplace, including Unheard, The Washington Post, Calgary's The Sprawl, and the Northwest Territories Cabin Radio. A key takeaway from the series is that there's far too much pessimism about the future of journalism. There's a lot of exciting innovation occurring within the sector. We've been thrilled to elevate it over the past several months. 8. We learned that it's possible to provoke academic historians, as we inadvertently did with our dedicated series to mark the 25th anniversary of Occasional Hub contributor Jack Granatstein's influential book, Who Killed Canadian History? Our collection of essays and culminating podcast episode with Granatstein himself received a decidedly negative reaction from university-based historians who ostensibly felt that the series' sustained criticism of the field's inward, identity-obsessed turn hit a bit too close to home. We don't intentionally seek out conflict at the Hub, but in this case we interpret the backlash as a sign that we're on the right track. 9. We learned that the Hub's collection of contributing writers is, pound for pound, the best in the country. Ginny Roth is the only columnist in Canada consistently writing about family structure, fertility, and contemporary feminism. Trevor Toome's economic analysis has quite literally come to shape how others are thinking and talking about Canada's economy. Joanna Baron regularly brings a smart and principled perspective to Canadian constitutionalism. Michael Kempa's thoughtful writing on issues of policing, law enforcement, and national security cannot be found elsewhere. Richard Shimuka's deep knowledge of defense and national security helped us to navigate an increasingly complex geopolitical context. Anthony Anderson's writings on the fading episodes of our history provide an invaluable service in promoting Canadian heritage. Patrick Luciani's examinations of current events in his book reviews are incisive and indispensable. And where else in Canada can you find a regular wine column, let alone one as insightful as Malcolm Jolly's? And of course, Howard Anglin's extraordinary range is a delight for Hub readers, even in those instances when we need to turn to our dictionaries. If the Hub's content is its key to success, then our diverse and highly talented group of contributors is our comparative advantage. 10. Finally, we learned once again how fortunate we are to have thousands of people whose financial support, subscriptions, and growing readership have enabled the Hub to grow and flourish. Thank you. We quite literally couldn't do it without you. If you'd like to join the Hub community and support our mission, you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter or donate now.
That was a commentary by Sean Spear. He is the Hub's editor at large. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Michael Kempa, writing on why Justin Trudeau's well-rehearsed testimony reassures no one.
Earlier this week in Ottawa, I sat in the beautiful Bambrick Room of the Library and Archives Canada building and witnessed the Prime Minister of Canada along with his key ministers give sworn evidence to the public inquiry into foreign interference in federal electoral processes and democratic institutions, or PIFI. Under the fluorescent lighting and surrounded by oil paintings of sections of Canada Pacific trains and various bits of the Canadian landscape, Trudeau and company put on an hours-long masterclass in delivering a droning, legalistic message whose technical accuracy aimed to divert attention from the latest and most important controversies damaging their aging Liberal government. The disciplined messaging set up all week was capped off by Prime Minister Trudeau's uninspiring testimony. For more than a year, Trudeau and his government have been unwilling to provide any real insight into what information CSIS or our other intelligence services had shared with them about allegations of hostile ideological opponent states secretly meddling in our politics. While the public had been alarmed and outraged by extraordinary media reports of leaks by ex-CSIS operatives claiming the People's Republic of China had lent support, in the form of delivering nominations voters and untraceable donations via proxies, to candidates it considered strategically better suited to its cause, Trudeau was essentially mum on what, if anything, his government had been told about it or had done about it. Other than no comment on questions of what he had been told and when, all Trudeau would really say up until his testimony was that there was not a shred of evidence that the overall electoral outcome had been impacted, or the democratic will of the people had been consequentially undermined. It is important to stress that, thankfully, he is right about this, though that comes as cold comfort to the handful of candidates whose ridings were potentially affected by the interference. But then, on the stand and under oath, Trudeau appeared to open up. The Prime Minister was clear that he, his advisory team, and his ministers had indeed received many briefings from CSIS and other bodies about foreign interference. In particular, focusing upon the efforts of the People's Republic of China to skew nomination contests where election candidates are chosen by local members. Strangely and surprisingly, the Prime Minister explained that he, in fact, does not tend to read said intelligence briefings but instead relies on advisors to brief him orally. These briefings go back to the fall of 2019, when CSIS told Jeremy Broadhurst, Trudeau's nominations and elections point man, that it had real concerns about irregularities that appeared to be coordinated by the Chinese consulate office in Toronto in the nomination of Han Dong, who went on to be elected as the Liberal MP for Don Valley North. As a frequent public critic of the Prime Minister's politics, I should not be accused of effusive praise for pointing out that Trudeau is in his element on the stand at public inquiries, to the point that he seems a completely different politician from his standard public persona. In public, he is an often contrived, casually dressed, or elaborately costumed man with an interrupted delivery and a tendency for unscripted flubs. On the stand, he was a different animal altogether, one who is in impeccable business dress, sitting in a still and naturally commanding fashion and moving quickly and without pause across wide-ranging questions, all while being calmly dialed into detail. It was this Trudeau who walked Justice Hogue and legal counsel through meetings he had with CSIS, his ministers, and his advisors, as well as the decision-making process they deployed. Most notable is an October 2019 meeting with Broadhurst in an Ottawa airport holding room before heading out on another leg of election campaigning. Here Trudeau said he asked his advisor about the quality of the intelligence he had been given on the Dong nomination. Broadhurst told him that CSIS had some concerns Beijing was leaning on Chinese nationals in Canada with student visas to board buses and vote for Dong. Trudeau wanted to know if Dong knew about it and was a witting beneficiary. Broadhurst said there was no intelligence to suggest that. Trudeau then asked his campaign director if it was a close enough nomination that the outcome could have been determined by these potentially nefarious foreign nationals. Broadhurst assured him that the margin of victory for Dong was wide enough that a couple of dozen improper votes would not have made a difference. Case closed, I guess? Then came the legalistic masterclass, where Trudeau returned to the impressive-sounding thresholds argument that his ministers and staffers had spent the previous days of testimony setting up. Intelligence is not evidence, Trudeau repeated this week. What CSIS reports to the government is what it learns through informants and snippets of communications it may successfully intercept. As such, he explained, intelligence does not meet the standards of evidence for decisive government intervention. This is true at the level of criminal investigations and charges, for example. For Trudeau, given that he had in hand only suggestive intelligence of wrongdoing not directly tied to Dong and that the nomination outcome appeared untainted, he did not consider the threshold had been met to overturn a democratic nomination, or remove or even discipline the candidate. What he would do was follow up with Dong in a way that would not compromise CSIS's ongoing efforts. It is technically legally correct to say that very often mere intelligence cannot be the basis for criminal investigation or professional discipline. However, that should not distract from the fact that good intelligence should and must serve as the basis for real political and policy action. Why Trudeau and company subsequently took none remains inexcusably unanswered. If you accept Trudeau and the company's testimony that CSIS had repeatedly provided them with warnings that nominations and donations were prone to foreign capture since just before the 2019 election, why were no steps taken to plug those holes for 2021 or for 2025 and beyond? During the media reports of CSIS leaks going back over a year, and following the farcical investigation and reporting of Special Rapporteur David Johnston, the idea has begun to creep into the public consciousness that the nominations processes of all major federal parties is the Wild West of Canadian politics, taking place mostly outside the regulatory gaze of Elections Canada and under the winking regulation of political parties themselves. It is well known that parties have a variety of levers they pull to accommodate their preferred candidates. The timing, location, duration, and eligibility rules of nominations can be manipulated. Seeking my own nomination for the Liberals in Scarborough in 2015 and working on the ground at many others on the east of Toronto around that time, I have seen many busloads of confused-looking, homogenous groups being herded by community leaders with clear instructions on who to vote for. And I have seen friends have piles of supporters' memberships expire with the turning of the calendar to a new year just as high-profile candidates have entered the contest late. However, levers go both ways, and foreign governments appear to have jumped on the Liberal Party of Canada's unique allowance of foreign nationals with student visas to have a say in who will ultimately stand for election in a given riding. Surprisingly, the party does not require aspiring members to be citizens or even permanent residents. They must simply ordinarily live in Canada. Facing mild questioning at the inquiry on why such a practice would be permitted, now independent MP Dong offered the argument that inclusion provides foreign nationals with a first taste of the experience of the democratic process. While this argument may hold more sway for permanent residents who are rooted in Canadian society and further removed from the reach of the often hostile governments of their countries of origin, it is more difficult to swallow for mere students who potentially remain under their nefarious thumbs. It remains early days for the inquiry. The head of CSIS, David Vigneault, has been recalled for an unplanned second round of questioning on Friday. At issue will be whether the spy agency forcefully delivered the message to the government that nominations and financing were ripe for capture, or whether their verbal delivery of written speaking notes took a little bit of edge off the message. There will also be questions of why CSIS toned down the language of some of its written reports after meetings with the PMO. Were CSIS edits due to political pressure, or did the government simply provide more information that genuinely moderated the agency's assessments? On this, it is doubtful Vigneault could say anything other than the latter and keep his job. Nevertheless, Vigneault's answers will be vital for plugging the holes exploitable by the People's Republic of China and other foreign states in time for the 2025 federal election. We await the first report of the PIFI, set to come on the 3rd of May.
That was a commentary by Michael Kempa. He focuses on exposing the politics behind policing, security and criminal justice operations, policies and reforms, and is based out of the University of Ottawa. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.